Good morning, everyone. Just a couple of stragglers coming in. I'm your chair for this morning. My name is Sam Fuller. I'm really pleased to introduce Lisa Simpson, talking to us today about the future of workers' compensation. Lisa is a partner in the actuarial practice at PwC, specialising in providing advice to injury schemes for more than 20 years. Lisa is currently the scheme actuary for WorkCover Queensland, WorkSafe Victoria, the TAC and NT WorkSafe. I have to say, I've actually had the pleasure of knowing Lisa for quite a long period of time. We worked together when I was at PwC. Many people may not know this, but Lisa actually came over from the dark side from life insurance quite a few years ago. So, welcome everybody.
Thanks very much, Sam, and thank you all for coming along today. It's quite a large group here, and I'm assuming that you're all here because you've got an interest in the topic. You might have heard that I lost my voice yesterday, so what I might do is capitalise on your interest in the topic and do a fairly short presentation and hand it over for comments and questions. Hopefully more comments so you can talk amongst yourselves. So I'm really going to just touch on two parts of this massive topic today. First of all, looking at the impact of demographic and workplace changes, and then also looking at the health landscape changes and what each of those aspects are likely to do to the future of workers' compensation. But before I start, I might just get a bit of audience participation with a bit of a pop quiz. So who in the room owns a smartphone? Put your hand up. Yeah, I think that's almost everybody. And who in the room has used the rideshare service Uber? Will you hand up? Wow, that's not almost everyone, but it's pretty close. That'd be 90%, I reckon. And who here has used the accommodation service Airbnb? Again, look at that. That's 80% maybe, but yeah, pretty prevalent. So, you know, we've had smartphones for about 10 years now. Uber's been in Australia for about 5 years and Airbnb also 5 years. But now we can't really envisage a world where those things don't exist. And they've really revolutionised our communication and our ways of working in many ways, with smartphones in particular, our contactability. And what is that doing also to maybe the prevalence of mental health in our workplaces? So how many of you put an out-of-office message on your email while you were here for 2 days rather than just checking your messages in between each session or even during sessions? So out-of-office, yeah, only a handful. So you can see our connectivity is changing. And, of course, Uber and Airbnb are really great examples of disruptions to workplaces. They have significant impacts on our labour force, on the skills required, on retraining opportunities and on employment relationships. So you may have actually heard in the news yesterday that there's a court case that's happened in the UK around Uber and whether or not Uber drivers are employees. And for all intents and purposes, the court in the UK determined that they are in fact employees because they don't have significant control over their work, their rate of pay and their working conditions. So you can see that these issues are being worked through. That decision will be appealed, I think, straight to the High Court. But you know, these changes are going to become more frequent, and trying to figure out what that means to employment relationships and the future of workers' compensation is really current. So this afternoon I'll take you through an overview of all the demographic and other workplace changes in the first half, and then we'll switch to have a look at the topic of healthcare and the provision of healthcare services. So another pop quiz to get us going. Who's wearing a Fitbit today, or who has one at home and didn't bring it? Yeah, a little bit less prevalent. All right, we already know lots of people have smartphones, but of you people who have smartphones, who has apps on their phone to track their health, their mood, their sleep, you know, to do meditation, smiling mind, that sort of thing? Yeah, actually quite a few of you. Yep, okay. And who has an electronic health record? Oh, 2-3 handful of people. So we still don't trust that form of technology. But who's used Dr. Google when they wanted to look up what might be wrong with them. Yeah, almost everybody. Right, so the way that we're consuming healthcare and health services is really changing. And that changes what we expect from a workers' compensation system. So how do our systems evolve to keep track with our expectations and how we want to consume health as health, how do we want to consume health services? So let's start with topic one, demography. I'm going to touch on four areas of demography. First of all, who are the workers of the future? And that includes looking at their age profiles and the mix of baby boomers versus millennials. Secondly, what will the work of the future look like? And that covers topics like looking at the change in industries and what types of work will we be doing. Then we're going to look at briefly at how we're going to be working, and that includes things like the mix of casual versus full-time workforce, the rise of the gig economy, the greater use of self-employment arrangements and multiple employer relationships. And then we'll look at other things, all other things. And the biggest thing, I think, within other includes the use of technology and how that transforms our workplaces, things like robotic process automation and AI, which are very topical at the moment. Start off with the who are we and how are we going to change into the future. So we are an ageing workforce. That's not a new trend. That's a trend that's been going for some time, and this is due to gains in life expectancy, improved health, increasing female participation in the workforce, and that female participation moving now into the older age groups as well, and it results in also changes in generational mix. So the left-hand chart up there shows the mix of employed persons within each age group. And you can see in this chart, if you can see the waves, there's various sort of waves moving through that. That's the baby boomers coming through each age group in the workforce, and they're actually now starting to emerge in the 65-plus age group. And so now we have, you know, the baby boomers perhaps working even longer into later ages than previous generations. At the same time, we have millennials coming in. So we have such a mix of people in the workforce in terms of all the different generations. On the right, we've got a graph of Victorian experience, which looks at claim frequency by age to try and understand what the impact is of that ageing population. And you can see that the claim frequency increases over time, and it roughly flattens off at about age 50 or so, and before tailing off. But mostly the tailing off, I think, is because of the mix of professions within those older workers. There's not as many workers, I guess, in high-risk professions at the older ages. So what does this mean? What does this mean for the future of workers' compensation? So what? So what this means is that as we get older, a mix of workers will have more gradual onset injuries in our workforces, and I guess it becomes harder to separate work-relatedness from ageing in the impact of those injuries. We also know that mental injuries increase with age up till about age 54. We know that from Safe Work reports. So with older age workers, we're likely to get more mental injuries. And workers are working for longer periods, and that's changing the view of retirement. And so therefore, we'll need to adapt workers' compensation schemes to consider benefit periods for longer periods into longer older ages. We'll have more older part-time workers as a result of this. So we also need to consider that workers' compensation is part of a system here, and we have to consider how it interacts with the age pension and also other sources of income, particularly those benefits through life insurance. So, and we also know that it's harder to achieve return to work, can be harder to achieve return to work for older workers. They take longer to recover and can have other more comorbidities present. So that's a look at who. Now look at what. So this graph shows the change, the projected employment changes in the next 5 years. It's only a short time frame, but actually this represents trends which have been present in the Australian economy for some time. So what we're seeing is that over the next 5 years, the biggest growth area will be in healthcare and social assistance, which makes sense also because of what we know about the NDIA, a growth in health in the attendant care workforce required there. Professional, scientific and technical services are on the rise, as is education and training. And conversely, manufacturing and essential services and agriculture are on the decline. So what does this mean? It means for older workers, for example, who've been made redundant after a lifetime of working in manufacturing, the significant retraining is required for future employment because the jobs growth of the future is at much more skilled levels. So what we do know, a similar projection by skill level shows that the biggest area of growth is going to be in jobs which require a bachelor's degree or higher. So it's going to be a real shift required in order to bring people through into different work in the future. So for workers' compensation schemes, that's pretty hard. And I think what that means is that you need to be really linked in well in terms of the Commonwealth system as well. We need to get better linkage between retraining options for people who really aren't going to be able to return to work in the same sort of employment they've had in the past. And the other thing, I guess, that arises out of this industry mix is also an ongoing change in type of injury. So over time, with less manufacturing jobs, it's likely we'll get fewer physical injuries, and the increasing trend in mental injuries will continue into the future. So that's the what. Let's have a look at the how. So these graphs show the mix of employment type for men and women, between full-time employment in blue, and orange shows part-time employment, and then those looking for work either full-time or part-time. So you can see for women it's almost half of the workforce is in a casual, part-time employment. And over time, the proportion of the total workforce in part-time employment has increased from 21% to 24% over the last 20 years. So that's also as women are having greater participation in the workforce. The biggest sectors for part-time work are retail, trade, accommodation, and healthcare and social assistance. If you remember, I just said healthcare and social assistance is the biggest growth area. So one of the biggest growth areas is also one of the areas which has the highest proportion of part-time workforce. So over time, it means that there's going to be more and more part-time work. And not everyone wants part-time work. Some people are really looking for more hours and are unable to find it in the current economy. So that also leads to a situation where people seek second jobs and therefore have multiple employers, which creates a situation for workers' compensation which makes things complex. So what does this also mean? If we have more casual or part-time employment, casual workers or people who are changing jobs or having multiple jobs more frequently can, of course, have less training in health and safety and therefore be more exposed to injury than people who are in full-time employment. And we do see this playing out, for example, in labour hire in workers' compensation. Quite often, premium rates within labour hire are higher than for organisations which employ full-time workers. So as we get more people who are self-employed and in the gig economy, and add that to the mix of having potentially more than one an employer under a normal, under a traditional employment relationship, you can see the complexity just multiplies. So how do we figure out who caused the injury? What do we do with mental injuries where, you know, the person's unable to work across all their forms of employment? So these are issues we have to grapple with. Let's look briefly at other. So, I mean, one of the biggest things we mentioned about other is the use of technology, AI and robotic process automation. So when we hear the predictions that autonomous vehicles are likely to replace all drivers within the next 20 to 30 years, and then we look at things like assistive technologies and the amazing role they play in the provision of healthcare services and the reduction of the labour intensiveness as a result. So, and the other example, I guess, is we've got more staff mobility, more people working from home, or even from a conference venue like you are today. So what do these sorts of changes mean also for the future of workers' compensation? Well, I think the biggest thing around technology changes is that it tends to replace low-skilled workers. And so, again, it has the impact of making it harder for those workers to find employment in the future. And I guess where we do see that playing out already is in welfare utilisation, and that's why I've got these graphs up here. So this shows us by age group the proportion of people using different welfare benefits. And the one that I would like to call out most clearly is the orange one, which you might not be able to see very well. Here's a clicker. Orange there and orange there. And that's the disability support pension. And the age group I've highlighted there is the 55 to 64-year-olds. And you can see that increases quite significantly. And that's, I guess that's the workforce that maybe has been in employment and has maybe lost their job through redundancy in manufacturing or other sectors which have been on the decline. And then, you know, how do those workers get back into the workforce? Well, I think a lot of the time they end up in disability support pension, as some of the evidence shows. So in the future, we really need to consider the interaction with other systems and really look at this from a whole of government perspective. So if we have sectors in decline and sectors growing and changing technology, what can we do to assist those workers who are injured and need to get back to work, taking a whole of government approach? So just summarising the demography. So we really need to look at the product design and coverage. In the future, maybe we have workers' compensation that's more flexible, and it's actually coverage opens up, and we maybe look at the concept of working rather than worker. I mean, that might be a big shift, a big step, but if you look at the approach that's taken in ACC New Zealand, for example, they cover everybody and they have lots of different accounts to sort of fund the cost of those injuries. What if we said we're going to fund everybody who is working, and maybe some of that's funded through workers' compensation, some of it's funded through the tax system? You know, big, bold changes, but maybe that's something we need to look at. We need to continue to find innovative and flexible ways to incentivise return to work where there's multiple employers and employer relationships. And we need to look at people's life situations, including the availability of other insurance and how they interact from a whole of government and whole of person perspective. So I'll just change tack now and discuss health. So a bit of background in health insurance. In the 2014-15 financial year, Australia spent $162 billion on healthcare, and out of that, the government funded 67%, and we all, including our private health cover, funded 27%, and the rest was other funding, including about 1% from workers' compensation schemes and 1% from motor vehicle insurers. Sorry, motor liability insurers. So really, at the end of the day, workers' comp and motor liability are real price takers in this market. They play a very small part in the overall health funding. And so taking that into consideration, what do workers' comp and motor liability schemes need to do in terms of looking forward into the future for healthcare? They also need to be aware that costs are increasing due to our ageing population and increasing medical technology. So it's projected that our government contribution to healthcare will increase from 6.5% to 10.8% of GDP in the next 50 years. So workers' compensation and motor liability will be impacted by those trends as well. So what is the healthcare of the future going to look like? And there was a primary healthcare advisory group who did a research paper on this topic. And they put forward a model with recommendations for reforms to improve patient outcomes. And I think that's, we've heard that over the last 2 days a number of times. The schemes want to become more person-centric and focused on person-centred outcomes. Excuse me. So there's lots of recommendations coming out. And these are the main ones, that the future primary healthcare model needs to engage patients and carers as active partners in decisions about their health and well-being. The model needs to ensure service and funding models are based on best practice to maximise patients' health improvement, service safety and quality, and allow flexibility. And the model needs to drive efficiency in healthcare, eliminate waste and duplication. We want to avoid hospitalisations. We want to have integrated and coordinated approaches to patient care. I think that's also a very common theme, wanting to get better coordination of care between different providers. Primary healthcare professionals need to be able to work to their full scope of practice, and it also, we want to support collection of data that gives us information about health outcomes, which has always been the holy grail, isn't it? So central to this model, really, if you look at it from workers' compensation perspective, is the ability of injured workers to really take a more informed and involved role in managing their own health needs. And what this really requires is that the health literacy of injured workers is increased from its current position. And look, there's a lot of, as we said, we're consuming health in a different way. Just our POP survey earlier showed that people are using Dr. Google, people are using apps to get to consume healthcare. We're a little bit lagging, though, in that regard. In the US, for example, there's a lot of information available which provides information on different treaters. People can actually be informed in their decision-making between different specialists they might be referred to. I mean, we're getting websites such as White Coat, which are starting to go down that path of giving us that information, but that's the journey we need to go on so that injured workers can be really informed in terms of their health service purchase and use. So we want to be patient-centric, we want to be data-driven, and we want to be integrated. I think they're three key terms that all the schemes are talking about. And I think the way we do this is by leveraging this idea of having the healthcare home that the primary healthcare advisory group put forward, and utilising health partnerships more strongly. And I think it's interesting to consider the evidence base for this change, this patient-centred model that everyone's talking about. And I think it's clear within the NDIA model, that's how that they've put established the model, with the principles of choice and control. And there's really good evidence base in the research as to the impact on patient outcomes from such an approach. So the Productivity Commission showed that client outcomes are improved across a range of domains if you have such a patient-centric approach. But it's a bit of a change from the current situation. I mean, the sorts of things we hear are that injured workers are really frustrated by their interactions with the healthcare sector often, especially if they get sent to multiple exams. And if the purpose of those exams is for impairment assessment rather than for helping them return to health, they quite often get different advice or different points of view from different practitioners in those situations, and they find it complex. And it's often where they'll seek legal advice to try and work their way through the system. And, of course, we know that people's existing mental health and perceived injustice can also impact their outcomes. This impacts their interaction with providers and particularly rehab providers. So there are issues in the current healthcare situation too, around the extra administration being required from schemes in order to be a provider in the system. And that can also lead to some GPs refusing to treat their patients when they have a work injury, and also being frustrated in the system. So there's a long way we have to go from the current approach, but I think in summary, the ideal model would be that the injured worker goes to see their GP in their healthcare home, and their GP can treat them in the first instance. And that for that 80% of injuries which are really straightforward, that's sort of the start and the end of the process for the person. They get referred to whatever treatment they need, and then all the payments and the admin get sorted out in the background so that it doesn't become a debate about what's covered and what isn't covered. You know, they get the treatment they need and they move on with their life. For the more complex claims, which I think most schemes are identifying as somewhere around 20%, they have a coordinated approach where a specialist coordinator liaises with the GP and other healthcare specialists in navigating the treatment, and it's evidence-based, it's data-driven, it's underpinned by best practice protocols. And then there's information in the hands of the injured worker to help them decide whether they want to go with referred specialist X or referred specialist Y. And of course, a lot of this also could be framed in outcomes-based commissioning, which is a current topic a lot of schemes are looking at as well. So they're my thoughts on those two topics. I don't pretend to be a specialist, so at this stage I very much welcome further comments and discussion, any questions you might have.
Thanks, Lisa. I'll roam around with a couple of mics. Very thought-provoking. Have we got any questions? We do have some time, and I'll try and get everyone out before lunch. I know everyone's dying for lunch.
Lisa, what are some of the schemes you work with doing to prepare themselves for the changing nature of work?
What are they doing? So I think at the moment they're admiring the problem, and you can see there's already there's a discussion forum starting around, I think, Carmel, who was I can't remember who mentioned that, it was on the gig economy. That's coming in the next few weeks. But, yeah, I guess it's more questioning what do we do. Each state I know is looking at Uber and trying to figure out the legislation. And they're starting to look at autonomous vehicles and say, what do we do about that? And looking at the legislation and does the legislation cope? So, with workers' compensation, it's no one's saying, well, what do we need to do to get the gig economy workers into our scheme? Some offer alternative products already if you're self-employed, voluntary products, but no one's looking at it from a, should we try to mandate that these workers join our scheme? And that's a big thorny issue. Yeah. So it's actually probably even bigger than individual schemes, almost at the federal level, that these decisions should be made.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Lisa. It's Jeff. Given how hard it is to change a workers' compensation scheme, I wonder if there's a way to allow a bit of experimentation. I wonder if a jurisdiction would be brave enough, for example, to allow a self-insurer to try some quite different things, or an industry group to try some different things.
Yeah. Look, I am aware also that the ACC is undertaking a big transformation. I think they are trialling some of these ideas, outcomes-based healthcare commissioning. I know that's on their website and their strategy document, and it's really targeted, so it is in the nature of a trial. Find some injuries, find some providers who want to get on board and give it a go, but small scale, and then see what happens and see if we can move that to other injury types and other providers, yeah.
Question in two parts, Lisa. Not necessarily gig economy, but multiple employment or casualisation that leads to multiple employers, and managing the return to work process where the claim is with one of the employers. Second part to it, the concept of pre-injury average weekly wage and managing the capacity aspects of that, where only one employer has a vested interest in the process. And I think that ends up being a statement, not a question.
Yep. I don't know if there's a question in there rather than a problem statement, but I agree with the problem statement. I don't have the answer. I guess that's one of the things we have to lean into and have that conversation.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for the presentation. A query to you and a bit of a comment about the intersection between comp schemes and the healthcare system. I don't agree with you that the comp schemes have to be price takers. I think the fundamental difference is that the rest of the healthcare system is directly funded from different sources, but the comp schemes should be purchasers. The problem is they operate as if they're just funders, and there is, while it's only 2%, if they actually exercised some control over their purchasing power, they could affect some fundamental shifts in how particularly sub-acute care is delivered.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that a lot of schemes are talking about how do we move more to outcomes-based purchasing, or, you know, not just paying for treatment. So while they continue to pay for treatment, they will be price takers. I think I agree with that point.
Any other questions? Does everyone really just want to get to lunch early? All right. Well, thank you, Lisa. Can everyone please put their hands together to thank Lisa for the presentation?